The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea, when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. The Destruction of Sennacherib, Lord Byron. Chapter 1. The Great King. The defenders of the city fought to the last man with a courage born of desperation, for they knew that surrender simply meant they would remain alive only long enough for their conquerors to march them out of the city, where their heads would be lopped off and added to the thousands of others already piled next to the wall by the south gate. Their position was, "Let the Assyrian bastards drag my corpse out. I don't have to make it easier for them." At least, that's how he would have felt about it, the silently watching man told himself. He was observing the sack of the city from a vantage point atop a small hill a half-mile away, standing in a battered war chariot that had clearly seen a great deal of combat. His name was Al-Shur Samani, although he preferred to be addressed as simply Al. He was the king's older brother, and the general-in-chief of the Assyrian Imperial Army. Al watched impassively while the black columns of smoke spiraled up into the sky from the ruins of Lagash, and the faint sounds of screams drifted over the desert sands as the remaining males in the city over the age of 10 were butchered by the Assyrian soldiers. Although his expression gave no hint of his true feelings, he was revolted by the destruction of Lagash, not because of any squeamishness about the slaughter of the inhabitants, but because so many irreplaceable artifacts of the ancient world would be lost forever in the ruin of the thousand-year-old Sumerian city. On the hill next to Al's unadorned and well-used chariot was another, this one decorated with man-headed lions, griffins, and other symbolic creatures worked in gleaming gold. The second chariot looked as if it had never been in combat, as there was not a single scratch, dent, or other sign of wear to be found anywhere on it. Standing in the second chariot was a man who closely resembled Al physically, with the same strong, hawk-like nose, keen, black eyes, powerful musculature, and long, curling black beard with a few stray gray hairs in it. The resemblance was not a coincidence, for he was Al's brother. A moment's study of the two men's faces as they stood side by side, however, would have revealed one very noticeable difference. The second man's features had a more or less permanent expression of ferocity stamped on them, reminiscent of a predatory beast, making him look like a wolf in human form. This was not surprising, as he was Sargon II, great king of the Assyrian Empire, king of kings, terror of his enemies, slayer of thousands uncounted, blessed of the gods, and so on and so forth. Al's usual expression, on the other hand, was reminiscent of a slightly absent-minded philosopher lost in speculation about some abstruse, abstract principle. Since he had, in the course of his military career, personally killed more than 100 men, and had been responsible as Sargon's general-in-chief for at least 100,000 deaths, this may seem strange, but it was nonetheless true. The king gestured fiercely with his sword in the direction of the burning city and declaimed, "And so the fools of Lagash pay the ultimate price for their folly. For surely they were doomed from the moment they chose to contend with me, slayer of the mighty, to whom the gods have always given victory and always shall." To Al's way of thinking, his plan, consisting of a diversionary attack on the south wall which drew away the defenders while the main assault was made with scaling towers on the north side, had somewhat more to do with it than the gods, but he did not share this thought with his brother. Instead, he asked, "Is that so? Then how would you explain what happened when we last fought the Hittites?" He was reminding his brother of a battle in which the Assyrians had very nearly been trapped and annihilated in Anatolia, when Sargon had overruled him and rashly led the army into an ambush in a narrow mountain defile. Perhaps the gods were taking a nap at the time, or were away on vacation, he suggested sardonically. Taken altogether, Al thought his brother was not a bad man to work for, but from time to time he found it was necessary to let some air out of the king's swollen head. Sargon never liked to be reminded of his mistakes. Well, who did? and he would have probably taken the head of anyone else who would dare to speak to him as Al just had, or at least threatened to do so. Since he could not execute the offender in this instance, and he was not as clever with words as his brother, he was at a loss for a good response. He hesitated, scowled, and finally, in a peevish manner that added little dignity to his position as King of Kings, demanded, "Why do you always bring that up? You know it sets a bad example for the men when the General-in-Chief doesn't show proper respect for the throne." Having punctured Sargon's pretensions sufficiently for the moment, Al refrained from twisting the knife. "I only do it to remind you that you are human, little brother, and just as fallible as the rest of us," Al told him. "Not from any lack of respect for either you or the monarchy." Somewhat mollified, Sargon let the subject drop and pointed to a column of captive women being led out of the ruined city.